Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Every time I see that lonesome railroad train.
There is nothing quite so romantic as a train. Airplane and interstate travel have turned these engines of American mobility and prosperity into charming antiques. 98% of Americans have never boarded a city-to-city train, leaving these symbols of power and desire and freedom to chug along in old songs and a couple of great movies. Still, worldwide, 100 million people board a train each weekday morning, and trillions of tons of cargo travel by rail each year. Global commerce would crash without them. Author and journalist Tom Zellner boarded trains in Russia and China, India, the UK, US, Peru, and Spain to get an up-close look at the network of railways that connect the world. You can climb aboard with him in his new book, Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World, from the Trans-Siberian to the Southwest Chief. Tom Zellner, a pleasure to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Great to be here.
It is your own experience of the romantic nature of trains that in some way launched this book. Care to share that?
Yes. This was a kind of both a visual and an audio experience for me. When I was a kid in Kansas during the summers, I would hear the sound of a train whistle through the window at night. And it just was the most mysterious, the most lovely, kind of the most haunting thing that I had ever heard. And to this day, I think there's almost no sweeter music than a train whistle. And then many years later, I was riding an Amtrak through Pennsylvania during a snowstorm, and which is a really equally sort of like mysterious and kind of almost exotic kind of thing to go through. And across the aisle from me was a young woman reading a book. And she was kind of crying, actually. She was, whatever it was that she was reading had so moved her that it was kind of, bringing her to tears, as some good reading experiences can do that to us. And the motion of the carriages and the snow outside the window and the light overhead, it was just an amazing image. If I could paint, I would have painted it. And to me, there just seemed something so intrinsic to train travel about that image, and I've never quite forgotten it.
Well, you never spoke to her, but you do talk to plenty of strangers throughout your travels in the book. And you also speak to this combination that you were just referring to, the sound and the sway, this distinct but ineffable feeling of being on a train. You call it, in some points, the train sublime, that often leads strangers to talk with each other. What is that?
It's the freedom that you mentioned earlier. It's the freedom of movement within the train carriage that allows you to sort of, pass from space to space easily. It's not like an airplane where it's awkward and it's sterile and, most of us fly without ever exchanging a word with the person next to us, because it just sort of feels like a strange invasion of privacy. But, the walls are somewhat down on a train. It's friendlier. It's more communal. It's just an eminently civilized way to travel.
And, of course, you can walk to the bar car.
There you go. And that always makes it go down easier.
Trains still run in this American collective unconsciousness, and certainly the British, despite, as you point out to us, Brit Rail being pretty much eviscerated first in the 1960s, later in the 90s. You began your journey there in Great Britain. Why?
It is the motherland of trains. It is where the train was invented, in the coal fields of northern Yorkshire. And it was invented as a device to get coal out of the mines and into the cities. And what it did, much more than that, it kickstarted the Industrial Revolution. This was the world's first real machine. And there were press reports all over Britain of people seeing a locomotive for the very first time and almost going catatonic. Hmm. The human mind just didn't have room for this, This kind of weird spider-like thing sitting on the rails, that was huffing and puffing like, something that was alive. And so people ran away from it. When they would ride it, they would experience this kind of weird cognitive shock, The experience of traveling at 25 miles an hour was foreign to the consciousness, and the landscape sort of flickering by, and it really made an incredibly deep impression on the people who wrote it.
And that was back in England in 1825 when it was introduced. How does that train narrative compare the American and the British?
When it came to the early construction, the British philosophy was to blast through the hills, you know, use dynamite to level out the track and to build the track very well. We Americans, by contrast, with a more mountainous country and with more of a profit imperative, did it very quickly. And so when British surveyors came over and saw the sort of kind of helter-skelter construction that their Yankee cousins were building, they said, my gosh, old chap, what is this junk you're putting up? And the Americans would say, well, you know, Limey, you're doing it a little too slow. Mm-hmm. And so the experience of riding British rail was far smoother back in the 19th century.
We're speaking with Tom Zellner about the rich, imaginative, economic, and social history of the train. He's got a new book out called Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World from the Trans-Siberian to the Southwest Chief. Well, Tom, let's talk a little bit about it, trains in the American imagination, because we have so many unofficial poets laureate of train travel, one of them being Johnny Cash. Here he is in the 1974 documentary called Riding the Rails, The Great American Train Story.
You know, there's nothing that stirs my imagination like the sound of a steam locomotive. That lonesome whistle cutting through the night, and that column of black smoke and steam throwing shadows across the land. When I was a boy, the trains ran by my house, and they carried with them a promise that somewhere down the track, anything would be possible.
Johnny Cash, of course. You cite some of that literature in those country songs and blues songs from, you know, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison to these blues songs where the train is the bringer and the taker of love and sex and objects of desire and a way out. And you even relay a story that suggests that waiting for a train was the birthplace of the American blues. Can you tell us that story?
It was indeed. And not just the American blues, but the antecedent to all American popular music. And the cradle for this was the Mississippi Delta, where the field calls that the slaves and the sharecroppers would call to each other. This got mechanized, if you like. It was the railroad that ran through that rich agricultural region that made such a deep impression on the musicians. And so W.C. Handy, the great blues musician, relates the story of being in a railway station after midnight in the Yazoo Valley and hearing the strangest kind of music being played by a stranger with a guitar who was crooning on about where the Southern crossed the dog. That was the lyric that he was singing, and this made such an impression on Handy, the fusion of field calls with this rhythmic da-dump, da-dump, da-dump of the train. And so when you dig underneath American popular music, you're going to find railroad tracks underneath that.
W.C. Handy recorded Yellow Dog Blues with his band, but we also have a version of Sam Collins here recorded somewhere between 1927 and 31 playing it on a guitar.
Been out there for riding and I didn't want to ride no train. I want to ride the Yellow Dog Blues. Why did me change?
So as well as being an engine of social change, rail also emblematic of power, at least the lines conquering land and human spirit in many cases, certainly in the building of the Qinghai-Tibet Railway, the world's highest rail line, built with great determination by the Chinese. Why is this so symbolic?
Because it is a railroad that is not so much economic as political. The question of Tibetan independence has been sensitive and contentious for more than 70 years. And with this railway, which was built at enormous expense, and it truly is a marvel of engineering, It makes it very difficult to think of an independent Tibet because this is such a conveyance for people and ideas and commerce into that region that no highway ever could have provided.
And this is part of China's $400 billion investment in linking its super fast bullet trains and all sorts of connections all over the country. Besides a big power move in Tibet, what is it saying to the rest of the world?
It's saying that the Chinese are placing a bet that there will be continuing questions of energy in our future, that we cannot rely on an endless supply of oil, and that this is an energy-efficient and durable and reliable means of getting people to work and goods to market.
We do learn a lot about this tug-of-war over high-speed rail here in the U.S., especially California. You know, people are making the case for crumbling schools and deteriorating highways and against this sometimes apocalyptic scenario laid out by environmentalists if we don't have rail. Now, in all of these trains that you rode and all of these people that you spoke to, what have you learned about making the case for the existence and vibrance of rail here in the U.S.?
Right now, the political support for rail is primarily sentimental. It's those who recall the days when passenger rail was the way to get around, when it was more dignified and luxurious. You know, it sort of exists in sort of a ghost state, although, you know, I take it and enjoy it, you know, frequently as I can. In fact, when I lived in New Hampshire, when I lived in Hanover, whenever I would travel south, I would always try and take the Vermonter, which dropped off in White River Junction, Vermont. It's a wonderful train. It's a bit slower than the interstate. I'm not going to lie about that. But
it's about 10 hours, if I remember.
Yes. You've got to have a leisurely schedule. But if you like American landscape, and if you like seeing sort of the DNA, if you will, of our country, of how we built and of how particularly New England was settled, there really is no finer ride.
You know, Tom, I'm thinking of, you know, Bessie Smith singing about a train taking her love away, or George Gershwin, who apparently we find in your book composed Rhapsody in Blue based on listening to train rides. These are songs from another era, and they do have this kind of ghostly, nostalgic sense. Do trains belong to another time?
No. This is a technology which has never truly lost its edge. As far as efficiency of moving goods, you cannot do better. The physical trick of moving steel wheels on smooth rails, you can coast tons of material along that surface for pennies worth of oil. It's really quite marvelous. And the train turns out to be something that's really hard to improve. The discoveries of 1825 remain vibrant today. We do a miserable job with passengers, but as far as cargo is concerned, we actually do a great job.
Journalist, writing professor, and author of four previous nonfiction books, Tom Zellner, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Now, you can also find much more about Tom's newest book, Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World, from the Trans-Siberian to the Southwest Chief, on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Steam engines have long captivated the imaginations of children. Among the most popular train-based entertainment franchises is Thomas and Friends.
Are you ready to roll, Thomas?
Ready to roll with...
And slowly, the two engines clickety-clack.
After decades of TV shows and the toys and the films and an annual ride on the Conway Scenic Railroad, a number of critics charge that Thomas and Friends is sexist, racist, anti-Semitic, and otherwise dismiss it as a relic of another time. Jessica Roque is a writer and contributor to Slate. Her article, Thomas the Imperialist Tank Engine, carries on a rich tradition of critical analysis of Thomas and Friends. Here she is speaking with producer Taylor Quimby.
So the show itself is set on the Isle of Sodor, which is this very specific, very rural hilltops and clifftops and river, antiquated little island. There's no real city, and there's very few people, but there's all these little trains. Our hero is Thomas. It's this little blue engine, and all the trains work for a little top-hatted aristocrat named Sir Topham Hatt. It's really unlike other children's entertainment in a fundamental way. It presents a world of work. It's really not interested in childlike fantasy or wonder, I mean, aside from the talking trains, obviously.
Right.
It's based on rules that must be obeyed, and the very worst thing you can do is, as Sir Topham Hatt is always saying, cause confusion and delay.
Don't delay. Puff away. You all have jobs to do.
They're all in competition with one another. They're always trying to gain favor and position with him, and they relate to one another in a way that isn't particularly childlike. They sabotage each other. So unlike some other children's entertainment, Thomas isn't about cooperation. It's about competition. That's the kind of world that adults know very well. So it's very easy to read into it, I think.
Sir Topham Hatt has asked me to take this heavy goods train there.
Think again, Percy. Sir Topham Hatt asked me to pull this train, not you.
But Toby said I was to take it.
Toby? Since when does he tell other engines what to do?
Hello, everyone.
So how do social hierarchies play a role in your interpretation of Thomas the Tank Engine as a symbol of British imperialism, which you wrote about for Slate?
So it's very top-down. It does not correlate with kind of American conservatism, because American conservatism, it's conservative across the board, the kind of message of the show. But in American conservatism, there's this idea that anyone can rise to the top with, you know, hard enough work. But in Thomas the Tank Engine, all the trains are essentially vying to be in Sir Topham Hatt's favor, right? So you're basically trying to serve the aristocrats, trying to be right underneath them. They fear the foreign, you know, anyone who comes from other places, they're immediately kind of cast out, or they have to adapt to the Sodor way. Anyone who tries to do something else or wants to do something else, they're humiliated and judged. You know, there's a really poignant one in which one of the trains is just kind of dreaming about being able to fly like a helicopter, and the other trains just humiliate him mercilessly. You know, it's really kind of cruel.
Grand engines don't collect garbage cars, Whiff. To be a grand engine, you must be strong, fast, and loud. And you'll never be any of those.
The message again and again is that the most important thing is to do your job efficiently and to try to serve the order best.
And as Sir Topham Hatt would put it, to be really useful.
Yes, exactly. That is the highest compliment that Sir Topham Hatt can give.
The engine that has been the most really useful, by the end of the day, will pull the Joby logs to the search and rescue center.
Now, you didn't mention at the very bottom of the social hierarchy are diesel engines, which for some reason are much, much worse than the steam engines, or as they call them, steamies.
Well, yeah, in the Thomas universe, Thomas and most of the other trains are steam engines, and they're presented as just clearly better than quote-unquote dirty diesel.
Diesel oiled over.
I hope Sir Topham Hatt chooses me. Every day I make sure I'm a really useful engine.
What about me, Thomas? I'm a really useful engine, too.
No, Diesel. I'm sure Sir Topham Hatt means a really useful steamy. You'll never be that.
But what's most disturbing about the diesel-steamy dynamic is that you feel sympathy for the diesels, but within the show, the steamies are never corrected in their cruelty toward them.
Yeah, there's this class structure, and instead of it being part of the moral, it's really just an established part of the show.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Do you think it makes any sense for us to be questioning the logic of a children's show? I mean, are we being crazy, or is this just the natural thing as a parent, you know, forced to watch talking trains engage in bizarre social behavior to do? You know, is this just us sort of riffing because this is all we've got to work with.
I mean, yes, to a certain extent. That is, you know, you are forced as a parent to watch all kinds of things that you really can't believe you're watching all of a sudden. But but I do think that there are, especially with Thomas the Tank Engine, it's really difficult. I mean, there's been all kinds of interpretations, all kinds of different lenses through which this has been seen, not just the kind of British imperialist, but, you know, it's been seen as fascist and racist, sexist, anti-Semitic, nationalistic. But, I mean, most critics find it fundamentally conservative. So I do think that just about all standpoints, you can say that the world it shows is a very kind of top-down, authoritarian, paternalistic society. But yes, I think although you can maybe read too much into things sometimes, mm-hmm. it's also, I think, a fallacy to think that there aren't any messages in children's entertainment. Of course there's messages. There are messages in all stories.
Taylor Quimby there speaking with the writer Jessica Roque. You can find a link to read her article, Thomas the Imperialist Tank Engine, at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, an anthology of writers, rockers, and fans reflect on why four lads from Liverpool became lodged so firmly in the American psyche. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
50 years ago this week, the Beatles landed on U.S. soil. They captivated fans, apparently desperate for something to scream about. It was February of 1964, and America was still reeling from the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The Beatles provided an ecstatic respite from the gloom, and the screaming hordes that greeted them spawned a movement and a new term. Beatlemania. Author and journalist Penelope Rowland was among the screaming hordes. There's a famous photograph to prove it. As a grown-up, she's been a writer for several different publications and is author of a new anthology called The Beatles Are Here, 50 years after the band arrived in America. Writers, musicians, and other fans remember. Penelope Rowland, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It seems that when we talk about this moment in history that people knew at the time, the Beatles were going to be huge. Regular people and budding musicians all knew that this was a defining moment. But why and how?
It's interesting. As I looked back at what the phenomenon was like, I remembered that we heard about the screaming girls long before we heard about the music. So I was part of the wave of screaming young women who were caught up in a frenzy. I'm not sure people knew how good the Beatles were. It took a while. At first, they were just a phenomenon. They were sort of cartoon figures. They looked funny. People, our parents were horrified. They were funny and rude, and they made us laugh, and they were irreverent. But I think the music is something that came quite slowly to us, how good it was and how long it would last, how they might endure as a band.
I'm trying to imagine what it must be like for parents, you know, who are watching the Ed Sullivan Show, used to watching, you know, Edie Gourmet or, you know, a plate spinner or something like that.
Yes.
Suddenly seeing their own children screaming, girls screaming. What was happening?
I don't know, but all I know is we knew we would scream. And I remember sitting in the family living room. I was the only preteen girl in the house. And I was screaming to the annoyance of my family, and I think this scenario was taking place all across the country.
Well, personally for you, your face is actually on the cover of the book. You are one of those girls screaming, anguished look on your face. But there's a personal story for you. It was a pretty tumultuous time for you.
It was. My mother had remarried and gone off on her honeymoon, and I'm sure that had stirred up all sorts of emotions for me. And I was simultaneously madly in love with George Harrison. It was my first true love, and I was convinced he was my destiny, unlike anyone else in America, of course. And so my mother left town and left us with our maternal grandmother, and as she walked out the door, she said, do not go down to the Beatles hotel and scream while I'm away. Well, of course I went. I had to go. You couldn't not. So I was promptly out the door, and I went down, and this picture was taken. My mother comes back a couple of days later, and the New York Times runs a photograph of me, screaming, the very photo that's on the cover of the book. And that evening, the phone begins to ring with people saying, isn't that Penelope in the newspaper today?
Boy, were you in trouble.
I was in such hot water.
Well, everybody has their own story, and you access so many of them. I'm going to go through the details of some of them. Michael Lavin, another fan, he writes about being cooped up in a hospital bed at Mass General. He's with a 6'11 basketball player from San Francisco. His memory on the Ed Sullivan Show was crystal clear, he writes. It's like where you were when Kennedy was shot, the same level of clarity, which brings up an interesting point about timing and about generational memory, I think. Do you think that the Beatles did take on a larger-than-life aspect and influence because their performance was just about 3 months after Kennedy's assassination?
You know, it's not a point I ever would have thought that the two would be linked, and this is something that came up over and over as I spoke to people. And I absolutely think there's a connection. I think that the world was so gray. And I remember it specifically because I remember walking home from, I lived in New York City, and seeing the grown-ups lurching towards me. We were sent home early from school, and seeing grown-ups crying everywhere you looked. And then 6 weeks later, the Beatles are here, and we're out in the streets again. And I have to think that the media really, really pushed the story because it was such a breath of fresh air.
Mm. Billy Joel writes about going from loving Beethoven and Chopin and classical geniuses to deciding to become a musician because of the Beatles. Bruce Springsteen recalls painting his aunt's house to raise money to buy a guitar after hearing them play. Are you surprised by how many musicians list the Beatles as the very reason that they became musicians?
I was, and also, or they changed focus. I remember Bob Dylan at some point, I quote in the book, as saying he knew when he heard them that music was going in a new direction, and he had to go. So even if they weren't becoming musicians, they were shifting radically. There's even someone in the book, he's not well known, but who threw in the towel, gave up being a musician when he heard them, because he knew he couldn't reach that level.
We're speaking with Penelope Rollins. She's a freelance writer and the author of a compilation called The Beatles Are Here. These are a collection of stories and remembrances of people, fans and some non-fans, of the Beatles arriving in the United States 50 years ago this month. One of the stories is also a mass media story of the time, Cousin Brucey's story about Ringo's St. Christopher medal being stolen and how he got it back. Tell us a little bit more about Cousin Brucey and what happened.
Cousin Brucey was such a huge, huge name then. I mean, he was the person we all listened to on the radio at night, and it was fascinating to talk to him again all those years later. The fans were frightening at times, and that's a point he makes, that it was, you know, the band was not always happy about screaming, frenetic girls surrounding their cars and all kinds of things like that. It was a volatile situation, and at one point, Ringo came to the studio, I guess, really upset because he'd been pounced upon by a group of girls, and one had taken this St. Christopher medal he wore around his neck. So Cousin Brucey was alert to the public relations aspect of this story. I mean, there was such competition among the disc jockeys who could be closest to the Beatles, who would get the share of the ratings. And Brucey didn't miss a beat, apparently. He went on the air, and he offered a reward, no questions asked, if you find it, and you can come on, and he'll kiss you on the air. And so sure enough, a girl appeared, and that was a big, it can be seen on YouTube, actually, to this day, the moment when she's a bit ashamed, I think, appears, but she does get her reward, and he gets his medal back.
Mm. You include some essays from people who weren't particularly fans. What did you think when you read their perspectives on the time and on the music?
Well, I thought the one who really stood out was Fran Lebowitz, who's, and I did
so
describe
funny.
Her as a non-fan. And that was an interview, and I called her up and asked if she'd talk to me, and she said, well, I didn't like the Beatles. And I thought, oh, bingo, because I really wanted a diverse group. So someone as articulate as she, talking about why she didn't like the Beatles, I had a feeling she'd have a lot of great things to say.
And in fact, she told you a fantastic story about many years later being at the same party with Paul McCartney. What happened?
She was sitting on a piano bench and it must have been quite a glamorous New York City party, and all of a sudden Paul McCartney sits down next to her, and it turns out he's about to play for the assembled guests, and she turns to him, classic Fran Lebowitz, and says, excuse me, I'm having a conversation here, which must have been the first time that's ever happened to him. She did not want to be interrupted, but he did go on and play.
Well, beyond this moment when the nation needed a sort of balm, as you were describing earlier, after the assassination of Kennedy, the Beatles went on for almost a full decade and then many decades more in our imagination. Did they indeed forever change things?
I think so. And that was the final and most wonderful lesson of doing all this research, was there was a reason they were so famous and they were the sinecure of all eyes, and the reason was they were that good. And what I found fascinating was to talk to different musicians about in what way they were good. They saw what they were doing in ways I couldn't see as a non-musician. But the other thing that was wonderful about them, yes, it was brief, but they kept moving ahead. And I remember almost being dismayed as the albums came out, because you'd be expecting one thing, and it was never there. It was something altogether different. And then in a short period of time, everyone was doing that too. So they were phenomenally inventive.
Penelope, I just want to make sure that you've gotten over the fact that you and George never did get together.
I know. Well, it's strange. I'm not angry with him anymore, because what happened is I shifted allegiance to Paul. And Paul I'm really angry with, because for the last 10 years I've lived in New Jersey, and he went and married another Jersey girl. I'm furious. So now I'm mad at him, too.
Well, I'm glad you got over it well enough to write the book. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Author and journalist Penelope Rowland. She's written for several publications, including The Daily Beast and Vogue. Her latest book is an anthology. It's called The Beatles Are Here, 50 Years After the Band Arrived in America, Writers and Musicians and Other Fans Remember. It's a compilation of reflections from a whole host of Beatle fans, and I guess some not so much fans. You can find more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming may be home to the most popular ski resorts here in the U.S., but when it comes to tough conditions, New Hampshire dominates. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to look into the history of skiing in New Hampshire and why our state grooms so many stellar winter athletes.
And then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day, and I'll send all my loving to you.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. 9 New Hampshire residents are competing in the Sochi Winter Olympics, among them 8 skiers, including alpine phenom Bodie Miller, who placed a disappointing 8th in this weekend's men downhill competition, and 1 snowboarder. So why does New Hampshire produce so many gifted skiers? Well, perhaps to understand, we need to look back. And joining me now to shed some light is Dr. John Allen, secretary and historian of the New England Ski Museum, located in Franconia, New Hampshire. He's also author of From Ski Sport to Skiing, 100 Years of an American Sport, 1840 to 1940, and the Culture and Sport of Skiing from Antiquity to World War II. Dr. John Allen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
New Hampshire is sending 8 skiers and 1 snowboarder to Sochi. Now, that's a pretty big share for such a small state. What is it about New Hampshire that makes for competitive skiers?
Well, it's had a long tradition, that's one thing. It had one of the major fulcrums around which skiing developed, Dartmouth, and Dartmouth indeed is sending a couple of skiers this year too. And it has always had a number of institutions which lend themselves to the production of good races.
Mm. I would think of these Western states with all of their big mountains being the progenitors of skiers. Here in New Hampshire, what about the smaller mountains and conditions? Mm. Do people learn to ski on smaller mountains, making them more adept at bigger ones?
No, not necessarily, but New Hampshire has certain conditions which make it difficult to ski, and if you can ski in New Hampshire, then you can ski anywhere. Mm. There's also a number of, in our area, New England really, a number of ski academies, and periodically kids come out of those academies. But it somewhat depends on the pool of youngsters that you have. And if you've got a big pool, which we do in the state, then the chances are fairly good.
The history of skiing at the New England Ski Museum points back 22,000 years to the formation of some of these mountains here. What's the evidence of the earliest skiers in New Hampshire? Did it predate European settlement?
No, the first skiers in New Hampshire were individuals who, for one reason or another, found that they could get around on skis. There was a kid, for example, in I think it was Ipswich, who went to school on skis. There were people over in the Hanover area that brought their skis to Dartmouth, for example, occasionally from the west. There was a well-known astronomer out of Hanover who did skiing. And then there were a bunch of Scandinavian, mostly Norwegian immigrants who settled in Berlin, which was called Norway Village to begin with. And so you begin to get various places in the state where odd individuals started to ski. And from those places, skiing grew.
What did early skiing look like in New Hampshire before the big ski resorts and snowmaking and lifts?
Done by very few people. Done out in the country. Don't forget, in those days, there wasn't alpine skiing and there wasn't Nordic skiing. There was only one sort of skiing, and that was you strapped on some fairly primitive sort of wooden boards, and you went out in the country, maybe with your dog or two, and that was about it. They were used occasionally for logging, doctors perhaps, and only when it sort of moved into the bourgeois, did it become a sport.
And when did that happen, in the 20th century?
Beginning late 19th, but basically early 20th century. And, for example, there was some sort of a club at what is now Plymouth State in 1907. The Dartmouth Outing Club began in 1909. And it was really from those sorts of institutions that you begin to get people who have disposable time and wealth to enjoy skiing as a sport.
And where are they coming from, Boston or from the big cities in New Hampshire?
Yeah, mostly from Boston. I mean, one of the reasons why New Hampshire does so well in the early days of skiing is because the routes are direct from Boston. It's very difficult to get to Vermont from Boston.
Hmm.
But not to New Hampshire. And so New Hampshire, when the ski areas began, had a real advantage. And if you look at the numbers of, let's say, snow train people coming up in the 30s, you'll find that they all came from Boston to New Hampshire. They didn't go to Vermont or Maine.
So it was in the 30s that New Hampshire sort of became a skiing hotspot. What set it apart from other ski areas in the country?
Well, first of all, it had a large urban population quite near, but they had already an infrastructure in the making. Partially, this was because certain well-known skiers got the ear of the governor, Governor Wynant, in the 1930s, to allow the CCCs, Civilian Conservation Corps
uh-huh.
to cut the trails, and B, for example, to build the Cannon Tram. And so they had already a kind of a forward-lookingness.
We're speaking with Dr. John Allen. He's secretary and historian of the New England Ski Museum about the history of skiing here in New Hampshire, a state that is sending 9 athletes, 8 of them skiers, 1 snowboarder, to the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. So people use skiing for recreation, but how about for competition? Was competitive skiing big in New Hampshire?
Yes. The moment that alpine skiing became popular in the 1930s, what happened was that people joined clubs. And when they join clubs, clubs like to go at each other. Mm-hmm. And so competition develops. And in one sense, you almost had to be a competitor if you wanted to sort of get in on the ski world because you were a member of the club. And there were different sort of levels of competition, of course. Kids' levels, and then adolescence levels, high school levels, and then the club competition. And some of them were really quite well known. There was a club in Boston called the Hockeybjerger, and there was the Amateur Ski Club of New York, and there was the Black and Blue Trail Smashers, and all those sorts of things. And they really went at each other quite extensively.
How about now? Is New Hampshire still a destination for competitive skiers?
Not really. Immediately after the war, this is after the World War II, mm-hmm. there is a general movement of the focus of skiing from the east to the west. And that was largely because many, many men who had been in the 10th Mountain Division and who came from the east and who trained out in Camp Hale, which is near Tennessee Pass, quite near Vail, Colorado, decided that that was the place they'd like to set up shop afterwards. And there's a sort of almost a mass movement of 10th Mountain people, and they all operate out of the West rather than New England.
What were some of the early judged events in the Winter Olympics, and how were they judged?
In the first Olympics, there were only cross-country and jumping.
Mm-hmm.
The arguments really were hardly over cross-country, but they were certainly over how to jump and what constituted a proper jump. To begin with, the form of jumping was simply as you would go over a bump, you would pick up your knees. And when the jump became a sort of venue all by itself, then the picking up of the knees, it was called optrekk in Norwegian, the picking up of the knees was the way to jump. But it became apparent quite soon that there were better ways to do it and which would get you further, and that was to stretch up and out so that the new way of skiing began to be judged in a very different way, and it also looked in many ways far more beautiful too. And this became the Riksstandardstil, as they say in Norway. That became the way that was judged.
So what will you be watching for when you're watching the Olympic skiing events at Sochi?
I shall be watching biathlon. I mean, biathlon is the most difficult thing of everything. I mean, everything is opposing. You're running, you're getting out of breath, you're sweating to beat everybody else, and then you have to suddenly stand or lie and shoot straight. I mean, it's phenomenal, the difficulties involved. All the other guys have it easy, as it were.
I don't know if I'd say that, but I thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Dr. John Allen, secretary and historian of the New England Ski Museum that's located in Franconia, New Hampshire. He is the author of several books on skiing, including From Ski Sport to Skiing, that's about 100 years of American sport from 1840 to 1940, and The Culture of Sport and Skiing from Antiquity to World War II. Thank you for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there is much more to listen to at wordofmouthradio.org. And we have a challenge for you. Valentine's is coming up on Friday. And with that in mind, we asked you on Facebook and Twitter for the greatest love and heartbreak songs ever written. We pulled together your submissions and are ready for a pitched love song versus heartbreak song battle. We invite you to cast your vote on which is the better bracket. Among the most popular love songs, Bill Withers' Just the Two of Us, The Righteous Brothers' Unchained Melody, and At Last by Etta James. On the heartbreak side, Bonnie Raitt's I Can't Make You Love Me, George Jones' He Stopped Loving Her Today, and Adele's Someone Like You. So which will win out, love or heartbreak? You can weigh in on our bracket at wordofmouthradio.org, and links to the ballot are also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and at Word of Mouth on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more love, heartbreak, thrills, surprises, and satisfactions of your curiosity tomorrow at 2 on Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.